Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Michelle.
And I'm Erica. Today, Mark Dunley reports on hearing about single-payer health care from Rochester.
Then, the Triple E's at the Black Expo, Part 2.
And later on, HMM, Roman Labor Correspondent Willie Terry interviews the General Secretary of the African Democrat Teachers Union.
After that, Part 2 of Corinne Carey's interview with Troy mayoral candidate Rodney Wiltshire on economic development and the attempt to make Troy a sanctuary city.
Finally, Geoffrey Roy Bogard recaps his experience as a nature lab intern with the sanctuary, and here are some headlines.
The Times Union reports that Governor Andrew Cuomo signed off on a bill designed to weaken Trump's pardon powers by narrowing the state's double jeopardy provisions to increase the ability of state prosecutors to take up cases that have already been resolved at the federal level. The state's passage of the law is tied to speculation that Trump might pardon associates that were ultimately indicted as a result of special counsel Robert Mueller's inquiry.
The Times Union reports that the site of former NL Industries factory is ready for redevelopment. According to the Federal Department of Energy, which owns the spot and wants to sell it or give it away. But the town of Colony is in no apparent rush to reuse the 11-acre site, which was a designated Superfund site contaminated with radioactive waste from the use of depleted uranium at the factory. The federal government spent $190 million over several decades to remove the contamination.
The Democratic governors of New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania met Thursday in New York City to try to develop a joint program to regulate marijuana and vaping.
Two businessmen were arraigned on Thursday in NYC on charges they conspired with associates of Rudy Giuliani to make illegal campaign contributions from foreign interests. Some of the donations were to committees supporting President Trump. Two other men previously charged in a case worked with Giuliani to pressure the Ukraine government to investigate the son of former Vice President Joe Biden.
A repair shop's improperly billed brake work had nothing to do with the catastrophic brake failure on a stretch limousine that crashed and killed 20 people in Schoharie. The district attorney prosecuting the limo company operator said in a court document filed Wednesday. According to AP, prosecutors contend other braking system deficiencies were to blame for the crash and would have been discovered through proper inspection and maintenance. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
Mike Sportiello serves as the Rochester Campaign for New York Health Chair. He discusses the recent hearing on single-payer health care with Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
So we're talking with Mike Sportiello, who serves as the Rochester Campaign for New York Healthcare Chair. He also works as a clinic coordinator for a clinic for the uninsured. He was one of the people, I believe, who testified at a recent hearing that the state legislature held on the issue of single payer. So, Michael, we certainly have had a lot of guests over the years, over the months, over about what New York Health is. But why don't you give people a brief introduction?
Absolutely. So what the New York Health Act does is it covers every New Yorker, the rich, the poor, and those of us in between, with no copays and no deductibles. And this is really important because right now we know that high costs are limiting families from bringing their children and themselves to the doctor when they need to go. As someone that works in a hospital, that works in a clinic for the uninsured, I see the problem on the impact this actually has on their health. The New York Health Act would cover everybody in the state and make sure that these problems no longer get in the way between you and your doctor, you and your nurse, you and your healthcare provider. Decisions should be made by patients and their doctors, not by the for-profit health insurance companies.
Well, one of the things that, some of the opponents of single-payer healthcare will argue is, oh, everybody wants to keep their present health insurance, and they want that choice. So how does New York Health deal with the issue of choice?
Absolutely. And there's two things I want to make sure to bring up here. First off is choice of a doctor, choice of a healthcare provider. And the other thing I want to bring up is choice of healthcare plan. So I'm going to start with the first one because it's a little shorter. So when we passed Obamacare in 2010, we were told if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. And this actually turned out not to be true. The for-profit health insurance companies get to decide who's in network or who's out of network. And that's still true today. If you like your doctor, I'm glad to hear that. But oftentimes what happens is people switch jobs or employers switch plans, and all of a sudden your doctor is no longer in network for that plan. And the doctor you and your family has been seeing for the last decade is no longer in your plan, and even though he lives down the block, you can't go see him. You can't go see her. And that's a real problem in terms of providing good care, good doctor-patient relationship. The second thing I want to bring up that you just mentioned is choice of plan. People say they really like their plan. I think that people like parts of their plan. Let me give you a personal example. I personally have a no-deductible plan with copays. It covers some medicines at relatively cheap costs, and other medicines that I've taken at relatively high costs have been a detriment and a barrier for me to actually obtain those medications. I like the part of my plan that is no-deductible. People compare their current plans to other plans they may have had in their life or to friends' plans and say, I like my plan. I only pay $50 for my kids' medicine that they need. I mean, my kid's life is worth more than $50 to be sure. That's a good deal. Well, sure, it's a good deal relative to the value of a human life. But relative to what we could be doing, insuring all New Yorkers with no copay and no deductible, including medicines, for less than we're currently spending now because there are no for-profit health systems profiting off of our families, that's the best choice. And that's what I say to people when they say they like their plan. You may like your plan, and under this plan, we're going to keep all of the same providers in network, but we're going to make sure that everything at front is no cost and no barrier to you and your family.
Now, recently, there was a hearing, I believe, in Rochester around New York Health. Why are these hearings being held, and what were some of the highlights of the hearing?
Yeah, so these hearings were held because we want people to know that this bill exists. So right now, the New York Health Act has one vote short in the state Senate, and has passed 4 years in a row in the state Assembly. So this is a bill that needs just a little bit of a push over the edge. We need one more state senator on board with this, okay? And the hearings are trying to popularize this. We want people to call their state senator and say, why don't you sponsor a bill that gets me their medicine for free? Why don't you sponsor a bill that ensures that my wife can go see the doctor when she needs to? Why can't I actually see the doctor that I wanted to see? Why isn't he in network? And the hearings popularized that by allowing the stories, the bad stories of that happen every day in my clinic, come out to the forefront. And there were several highlights of the hearings. People shared some really powerful stuff. One individual shared that his son, and it wasn't even an affordability issue, his son had forgotten to pay the $20 that he needed to renew his medication coverage for that month, okay? Again, some people can't afford $20, but this person actually could. He just forgot to pay it. And what wound up happening is he went to the pharmacy to fill his antidepressant medication, and because he hadn't filled it, the health insurance company wouldn't cover it, and so the price of the drug at the counter was far, far, far more than $20, far, far, far more expensive than it should have been. And he wound up committing suicide later that month. Now, I don't think we live in a world this rich, when we live in a country that's the richest of any country in the history of the world, when we have billionaires that make three people have more wealth than the bottom 50% of us combined, I don't believe that we can't afford to make sure that suicides like that don't happen. I believe that we can stop those, that we can insure everybody and make sure that cost isn't a barrier to our health care. That's just one of many stories.
Now, obviously, one of the things we've heard about the years is the number of people who are uninsured, but I also understand there's a significant problem with underinsured, and still, even after Obamacare, a significant percentage of people in America who go bankrupt due to high health care costs actually have health insurance, but it just doesn't cover them not sufficiently when they have a catastrophic emergency situation.
Yeah, it's a really big problem. So Obamacare did a lot. It brought the uninsurance rate in the country from 10% down to about 6%. Right now, New York is 6%, and 3% of New York children don't have health insurance. So to be sure, an expansion of Medicaid and an expansion of health care through Obamacare dramatically lowered the rate of uninsurance in our state. But that's not discussing the problem of, first of all, those 6% of people that don't have health insurance. That's a sad story. But it also doesn't cover the underinsurance problem. So since 2008, there have been a huge spike in these things called high-deductible plans. And what these are is that the insurance company will cover everything that they promised you, just not until you pay the first $5,000, not until you pay the first $2,000. And these high-deductible plans are becoming more and more common. In fact, around 40% of Americans are on something like a high deductible plan, which is up by a factor of four from 2007. And so when we're talking about actual ability to use your health insurance, we're talking about 40% of New Yorkers are on plans that are either don't insure them at all or insure them only after a huge amount of out of pocket expenses. I don't know about you, but if a medication cost me hundreds of dollars until I hit $5,000, I'm just never going to get a medication in the first place because I know in the long haul it's going to be too expensive for me and I won't be able to do it. And that's what I'm seeing in clinic. That's what we're seeing in our hospitals. Our patients are not doing the necessary preventative care they need, and they're not taking the necessary chronic medicines that they need for their diabetes, their chronic medications that they need for their asthma. And people are suffering as a result. In some cases, people are dying. People that are not taking their blood pressure medicines can get rebound hypertension and die within 24 hours of that happening. We see this in our hospitals, and it's not happening to the rich people. It's happening to those of us in the middle class and those of us with even less money than that. This is a fixable solution.
Michael, so we have a little bit under 2 minutes left. I'll give you a two-part question. I do remember a couple of years ago a study being done by, I believe, a professor in Massachusetts. He said if we had single-payer health care in New York, something like, can't remember the exact name, maybe $50 billion a year we would save in terms of overall health care costs. But cost is the big issue. Raising taxes is what they always talk about. So can you address the cost issue in 90 seconds? Plus, if people want more information or want to pressure their legislators, how best to do that?
Absolutely. So first of all, there's been a bunch of different economic analyses done, one on the left, one on the right, and one in the middle. I'm going to refer people to the middle. I want people to trust the numbers we're about to give them. You can easily Google the RAND Report's New York Health Act, and it'll spell out all the findings that they have. And what they found was that this saves New York State a ton of money, but more importantly, it saves the people of New York State, the families of New York State, a ton of money. And if you make less than $300,000 per year, you will save money under this new plan. And if you make more than that, then you're still be insured with no copay and no deductible. You'll just have to pay a little bit more. One might argue that taxes go up, but people don't care about taxes. People care about how much they're actually paying. If you can get a $3,000 tax increase with a $4,000 reduction in the amount you're paying for health premiums and deductibles, only an idiot would not take that deal, okay? This is saving New York families money. And the second part of your question, how do we get involved? Well, it starts off by going to nyhcampaign.org and signing the petition under the Get Involved tab, and we'll hook you up with your local organizers. Soon, in the Bronx, there's going to be another New York Health Act hearing, and after that, there'll be one in the Hudson Valley. So we need people with stories. We need people to just show up for each other and say that everyone deserves health care, not just the rich and powerful.
We've been talking with Mike Sportello, who is the chair for the Rochester Campaign for New York Healthcare, and this has been Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was HMM's Mark Dunley reporting from Rochester. Mike Sportello is the chair for the Rochester Campaign for New York Health.
H. Bosch Jr. and WOOC correspondent Willie Terry sat down with several vendors and entrepreneurs in the 2018 Black Expo at the Albany, New York Capital Center. Here are highlights from last year's interview.
Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr. of the Triple E's segment, Education Empowerment entrepreneurship. Today, I will be highlighting the first of a four-part series highlighting the vendors and entrepreneurs from last year's Black Expo, starting out with today's guests.
David Crapp from the Albany Law School, Law Clinic and Justice Center.
Correct, yes. Right. No, thank you.
So, David,
yes.
Tell me something about yourself.
Sure, no problem. So, yeah, as you mentioned, I'm a staff attorney. I work at the law school's community development clinic. Essentially, what our clinic does is we help support individuals and groups from dominantly underrepresented communities in helping them form their small businesses and nonprofit organizations. So we provide legal services around helping people form their businesses, deal with any contract issues or leasing issues. We help do some research for community groups that are trying to engage in sort of any community economic development related matters. So, you know, we're a new clinic. We started in 2016, so we're still getting a lay of the land. I'm from downstate, grew up in Washington Heights, Manhattan. I went to Brooklyn Law School, graduated in 2016. But I'm interested in community economic development work, interested in minority-owned business development. So, you know, this type of work is something that I'm very passionate about and interested in.
Yeah. You live in Albany?
And I live in Albany. Yeah, I live in Dalton, Albany. I've been living here now for going on 2 years now. So yeah.
So why is it important that we support, you know, minority businesses?
Absolutely. Great question. I think it's important to help support the development of minority-owned businesses because they, for the sense that they provide job opportunities, they provide wealth-building opportunities in minority-owned communities. You know, they give opportunities for families to have, you know, to be able to send their kids to college and things of that nature. But it also provides a sense of local pride in the community. You know, if you go to the corner or if you go to a local store and that's your neighbor and that's someone you know, you recognize, you're more likely to support them compared to maybe someone who's not from the community who comes into the community, you know. So it gives the opportunity for recirculation of money in the Black community, right? The more money we spend within our community, it recirculates, it gives more opportunities. So it's definitely a great opportunity to help support minority-owned businesses in the area.
So I know you said you're in the legal aspect, but do you have any family members that have some businesses?
Myself, I don't actually. No, I don't know. I don't have any family members that own businesses. But that is something that actually, you know, inspired me to want to get into this kind of work because of the fact that they're generally you don't see a lot of businesses owned by minority individuals and communities. So that's kind of what drew my interest more in wanting to continue to help Black-owned businesses develop and minority-owned businesses develop in their communities because, you know, there's so many people in the communities that have great ideas. They just need that support system, you know, to help them develop and grow and be sustainable.
And you have a lot of support from the Albany Law School to go out and do this?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're very supportive. They want us to be out here at these type of events supporting the community, kind of letting them know about our services. We do briefly go vice clinics in the community, so giving opportunities for people to get one-on-one consultations with attorneys about their businesses and nonprofit organizations. But yeah, this is something that we're trying to do, trying to get more into the community and help support the community's development and growth.
And so what did you think about the Black Expo?
This is great. This is awesome. I noticed a few faces that are familiar from my work in the clinic, so it's great that they're out here and they're able to get more exposure for their services and products. But this is exactly the type of stuff that we need, is more opportunities for Black businesses to be able to market themselves to the community, to be able to connect with each other. And, you know, these are going to be opportunities through mutual conversations that people are going to be able to connect and collaborate and do those types of things. So this is great, and I hope it continues to go forward.
Yeah. So, David, if someone want to get access to your service or to, you know, you or whatever, how could they?
Yeah, sure. The best way to reach out is through our phone number. It's 518-445-2305. You can also visit Albany Law School's website at albanylaw.edu and check under the Law Clinic and Center, and you'll be able to see the community development link that provides you with a list of the services that we provide, as well as an intake application that you can fill out if you're interested in becoming a client of the community development clinic.
And I noticed in one of your flyers that a small business legal network clinic, November 15th, what's that about?
Yeah, so again, this is an opportunity for people who have like questions, legal questions about their business, about their nonprofit idea, whatever it might be, you could get to come in, sit down, and have a free legal consultation with an attorney and get your questions answered. So it's kind of more into the actual, your particular matters, not just something general. It's actually going to give you the opportunity to get your specific questions answered about your business or nonprofit.
Okay, so if you have a small business or have a business question, it's important. You can go to the Small Business Legal Clinic, November 15th, 2018. You can have them from 6 to 8:30, and you can reach them at...
If you want to reserve your spot, you could call 518-435-1770. That's the Legal Projects office, and they'll be able to sign you up for the clinic. And we're doing this in partnership with the Community Loan Fund, Innovate 518, and the Institute of Nonprofit Leadership and Community Development.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And I'm here at the Black Expo, and I have as my guest, Thais Dixon. How
Hello.
You doing, Thais?
Good. How are you?
Right. Thais, tell me something about yourself.
So I grew up in Queens, New York, moved up to Albany maybe about 20 years ago, and just developed this business really this year. The name of my business is Thaiberry Sweets, and it is an edible chocolate and fruit-dipped arrangement company, where we specialize in chocolate-covered strawberries and edible fruits and sweets. I infuse chocolate-covered strawberries with cheesecake filling, as well as apples and a couple other things that I infuse the dipped fruits with.
So how did you get into this?
So the funny thing is, I've always done this as a...
At home.
I've always done this at home as just a gift to bring to a family get together. And then this year, a couple of members said, why are you not making this a business? So I did a soft opening in North Carolina at one of my family reunions, and it was very successful. So I came back from my family reunion August and signed up for the Albany Chamber of Commerce Entrepreneur Bootcamp, which I just completed that November 7th with a graduation on November 14th, and that's for local entrepreneurs that are starting a business or have existing businesses to strengthen your knowledge around the base of what really goes behind the work of starting a business. So it's been successful thus far. This is my second event that I've attended as my business, and you can locate me at Thaiberry Sweets at Instagram or on Facebook. I'm currently working on my website to launch. I did want to wait until I had all my legalities in place. So that is the gist around Thaiberry Sweets. I also, to give back to the community, I feature a monthly foundation, and this month the foundations that I'm featuring are Pancreatic Cancer and Epilepsy Foundation, because I have a daughter with epilepsy, and part of my monthly proceeds, I donate 10% of those. Anything that is purchased for this month, I have the Purple Girls. So any purple-based strawberry, apple, sweet that you purchase, I take 10% of those proceeds and I donate that to the local foundation for Epilepsy Foundation, which is the Epilepsy Foundation of Northeast New York, and in pancreatic cancer due to a couple family and friends that I have, and I feature one each month.
And is this a family business?
I am the sole owner.
You're the sole owner?
Yes. Currently, right now, sole owner. And I'm actually in talks with a couple local grocers who want to kind of display.
To market
it out and display them in their stores. So that's exciting. That's an exciting thing that just happened yesterday. I was contacted by someone to actually do a couple different occasions just to see how the product does in their stores.
So right now you're in the Capital District?
Yeah, so I work out of Colony. I utilize local commercial kitchens due to the fact that I dip strawberries in chocolate and I have cheesecake infused, which is dairy. You cannot do that from at home. So I utilize the local VFWs or the Elks Club, and I'm working with one of the churches, can't really mention their name yet, who have a commercial kitchen that I'm able to utilize. And I will be meeting with Troy Innovative next week because they do have a space that they think that they can offer.
Yes. All right. Thank you, Thais.
No problem. Thank you. It was nice to meet you.
Good.
Until next time, folks, it's about the triple E's: education, empowerment, entrepreneurship. And remember this, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe.
That was H. Bosch Jr. and Willie Terry reporting from the 2018 Black Expo.
For those just tuning in, I'm Michelle.
And I'm Erica. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. The Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, attended the New York State United Teachers Union reception for Magwenya Maluke, General Secretary of the South Africa Democratic Teachers Union, on Thursday, October 10th. In this segment, he interviewed Magwenya Maluke, who also is Vice President of Education International, a global union that represents more than 32 million trade union members.
I have as my guest, I hope I pronounce his name right, but he'll tell me if I don't.
Okay, yes, Magwenya Maluke. Thank you.
All right. Now, I heard your speech, and I do have some questions, because you talked a lot about some of the problems that's going on in the country, the infrastructure, the for-profit schools, overcrowding class, problems with inequality, unemployment, and stuff like that. What do you, in your opinion, what do you think is the root cause of all these problems, and what are some of the solutions?
The root cause of the problem has been the apartheid system, because we're dealing with the legacy of apartheid, which never government then built schools for majority of the people, in particular the African communities. So that is the root cause. It is the economic structure that the apartheid system has left that is also creating this particular problem, because the structural problem of the economy, that it is still more towards the white and not a more universal in terms of access to the resources and so forth. So that's one of the issues in terms of power relations that needs to be changing. So that is the root cause of the problem. The others are symptoms, where you have a new leadership that wanted to also exploit the situation instead of resolving the issue, but it is colonial problem that we see in Africa, in South Africa in particular.
You know, so a lot of us, we was working to end that apartheid structure here, trying to get this government to come around. Mm-hmm. When we look at the news lately, they talk a lot about some corruption going on in South Africa. Now, is this coming from just, let's say, businesses in the country, or is it coming from the people that were elected to represent the people?
I can say it come from both, because business will then be corrupting those that are elected in government in terms of favorable supply chain, and therefore paying the elected officials to favor the established business. And that is what in the country we're dealing with, the capture of the state by business. And that is another problem. So corruption to end is not to only deal with the politician, but also deal with corporation. The corporate world is corrupt.
Yeah. So when they liberated the country, when the country became liberated, free, were there some agreements made with other countries or multinational corporations so that the apartheid system, some of the things that went on in the apartheid system could still exist, some of the corporations could still do that, the people could still own their land. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem?
That is a constitutional problem that right. we are facing in the country because there were so-called sunset clauses. That was to guarantee that those who have the wealth will remain with the wealth. And those sunset clauses also guaranteed that at the beginning of this freedom and democracy in 1994, the Minister of Finance will remain a white Minister of Finance. Okay, so that to guard that particular wealth that they have accumulated over years, ill-gotten for that matter, and then it will continue to be in the hands. So it has been a constitutionalized issue. The issue of land, that the majority of the people, 87% of the country, of the majority black, don't have land in their own country, is constitutionalized. And therefore, for now, you need to go and deal with the Constitution in terms of Section 25 of the Constitution. And say, how do you ensure that the majority of the people also have access to land? Because land is wealth. Land, it's about humanity, it's about dignity. Without that, you are going to have this resentment, you're going to have this hopelessness, and so forth. So that is constitutional problem, that when the Constitution was finalized, it had favored those who have got the resources. Thirdly, it has is constitutionalized that you have a reserve bank that will be owned privately. It has got shareholders, and the Reserve Bank in any country has got to be run by government to ensure that it improves the economic growth, and then it are able to help government in terms of infrastructural investment and so forth. But our bank is not owned. The South African government can't even have a government bank because the Reserve Bank can't even license the government bank. Today, 25 years, we still have a bank that is called Post Bank, which does not have the same rights as the other five big banks that are there because of the problem of the Constitution in the manner in which it has made sure that the wealth remains with the few.
Do you think they're trying to institute a neo-colonial system there in South Africa, like Nkrumah talked about?
Yes, neo-colonialism is there in the country. Whilst the Constitution is a beautiful country, Constitution, but with those sunset clauses there that had locked the economy into the hands of the few, then you continue with neo-colonialism, basically. In essence, that is the power relations that must be changed.
Right. What about the U.S. foreign policy towards South Africa now? Has that affecting the country?
Well, the U.S. is still a very important player in politics in the world, given the economy and so forth. And South Africa has got bilateral agreements with that. And clearly it is that, as far as we're concerned from trade union, but the administration of the United States is in favor of the current status quo, that right, yeah. we must not have the land back. We have heard what Trump has said when the government took a decision to appropriate land without compensation, because for a period of 23 years, the willing buyer, willing seller principle was not working, because those who have got the land were not willing to share the land with those who don't have. And then he was saying he's watching South Africa. So clearly it is that we'll go the root of Zimbabwe if you appropriate right. land for the in favor of economic growth, in favor of a social cohesion in a country where you have people really respecting each other, because having no land is as good as not having a dignity. Having no land is as good as having no equality, and so forth. So yes, the United States administration can play a better role than to encourage the status quo where you have got inequality in our country.
And the other question I do want to raise is, what about African Americans from this country who really said they support the South African government? Are we doing anything here that might be helpful or yeah. could be helpful?
Yeah, we're beginning to interact with the trade union movement, beginning to interact with the communities in the United States in terms of the black the Afro-American. Mm-hmm. We can do much better. We can do more in ensuring that, one, we can start talking about the skills transfer, how we can help each other in terms of the skills, how can we mobilize the society again, like we did during apartheid, to then say, no, the government has not now detoured. It is off the rail. It has got to go back to the rail, and we must not keep quiet. We must be able to be clear about this particular thing without buying any other face. We call the president of the country of South Africa into here like you used to do in the past, where you say, please come and address what are you doing about poverty in your country? What are you doing about employment in your country? How can we assist? And so forth. So he need to come because we are one, and therefore we can help each other. So we see a huge potential from our own brothers and sisters in the United States in helping us to drive our trajectory of transformation, of building a strong developmental state.
Now, there was one question I wanted to ask. What is a typical day of a student in a classroom, like the curriculum? They're going to school. What would be the typical day or the curriculum that they go through?
Well, the curriculum that they go through on a typical day would be more of the academic work that they are doing. In majority of the schools, there's no art, there's no sports, so it will be just a pure academic instruction. That is a typical day of a student. But if you go to more affluent areas, they will have a school that has got, you know, recreational facilities. There's a school that will go for tours. Will be a school that will be taking the learners to learn outside there. But a typical day in South Africa will be being in the classroom,
Let me clarify what I'm really trying to say is that I know that, you know, the South African system, when their freedom struggle came, that there had to be like a real change into the core structure of that system. The books have to be thrown out, the history have to be rewritten. That's the question I'm saying.
Look, yes, the curriculum has changed. So a typical day of a learner in South Africa would be that you have got a new curriculum, which is more resource intensive. You have got new books, but those particular books have not taken into account an indigenous science, an indigenous language, indigenous cultures that are there. So you are calling for history. We are calling for some of the subjects or learning areas to be changed so that they reflect the real demographic of South Africa, a country that has got all people equal and so forth. So that's why we have a minister who said, yes, they will support that the history be rewritten so that it's able to reflect the struggles that the people have waged there, but also is able to reflect the structural and the stubborn legacy of colonialism and apartheid. So the real day, a typical day of a student is that you are still in an education system that is decorated by the features of apartheid based on power relations, because it is still based on the power of money that is in the hands of the white.
Just one last question. If you could say something to the American public about the problems or things going on in South Africa, what would you want to tell us?
What I would say to our brothers and sisters in the United States is that, look, we have the potential, we have the will to change the situation in our country. We need to be working together. We need to have each other cooperating and collaborating in the form of international solidarity that we have had when we were fighting against apartheid. So we need to fight the new enemy. And the new enemy now is inequality. The new enemy is the stubborn realities of apartheid. We thought in 20 years we could deal with that, but we can't. So we are saying to the public in America, please help us to be able to help the world to be a better world to live in. And we can do that if we are able to collaborate.
All right. Thank you. There you have it.
Gwena Maluleke. Thank you so much.
The speaker you just heard was Magwena Maluleke, General Secretary of the South Africa Democratic Teachers Union.
In the Hudson Mohawk Magazine's exclusive series on the Troy Mayoral correspondent, on the Troy Mayoral race, correspondent Corinne Carey talks to Rodney Wiltshire about economic development, the failed attempt to make Troy a sanctuary city, and where you can find the candidate around town being himself. This is the second of a two-part interview with Wiltshire, who is challenging incumbent Democratic Mayor Patrick Madden.
More than half of Trojans are renters. And yet we have very few resources and protections for renters compared to cities like Albany and New York City. How can we make Troy a better place for tenants? Do you support opting into rent stabilization like other New York cities are looking into?
I'm not really sure about that. I'd have to think about that or get some more information on that. But one thing I can tell you that I supported when I was on the council and that I fully support right now is a rental occupancy permit, so that the houses and the apartments that people are actually living in are suitable and habitable. That's one of the things that truly is a crime. You know, I go door to door and I go to places and I'm just like, how is anyone living here? And year after year, a lot of these landlords just bleed the houses, do nothing to put repairs into it, threaten their tenants. There's a lot of pressure that's put on people, and it's a bad scene. So that's something I'd like to see immediately, just to bring up the quality of the housing here in the area. But Troy is going through a lot of changes right now. A lot of it's in flux. So the city is kind of morphing, and I think that's going to be better. If rents are going, and I'm talking about free market here for a minute, but if the rents are going up and apartment class quality, I should say, the quality of living is starting to increase, that can put pressure on the landlords that have some of these other locations to improve their properties so that they're not, you know, inferior. They can't just keep raising the rent for nothing. You know, if you're going to pay $1,000 a month to live in a, you know, a terrible location, and then there's a nice apartment for $1,000 a month, you're gonna go over there. So the free market can do some of the work for us.
I moved to this area about 6 years ago, and from Brooklyn.
Okay.
And I remember when I moved up here, a lot of people said, "Well, there's been talk of a Troy Renaissance time and again, and it never really happens."
Yeah.
But I think it's pretty clear that there has been a renaissance, that Troy is on the upswing, and it's here to stay,
yeah,
really. But one of the things that divides us is how to address this period of economic growth without the city becoming overly gentrified, and also the development of the downtown as opposed to places like Lansingburg,
yeah,
North Central. Our bond rating is up. What do you have to say about some of the changes that have led to these positive developments? Do you credit the mayor's leadership? How do you see that conflict of a city on the upswing, but what does that mean for gentrification?
To answer this one, and I'm not just being political, no, I don't credit the mayor for this. He balanced the budget and worked on the books, and that's his job. And, you know, great, you showed up for work and you did your job. So, you know, you didn't go above and beyond. Now, as far as, you know, the renaissance and the actual upswing that we've seen, I credit the businesses and the developers that have come in here and that have said, I want to make Troy my home, whether it be small businesses or some of the larger ones that have been here. They see exactly what you're talking about. They see Troy as a cool place, a funky place, a place that's got a lot of opportunity, a place that is open and ready for business, and they are coming here. A lot of these projects that we're seeing come to light right now, and this is why I don't credit the mayor a second time there, is that they actually were in development when we were in office, when I was in office. So, and I'm not going to pat myself on the back, but a lot of these projects that we're seeing that are just starting to open up and become available for rent and even businesses, that happened under our tenure here. But at the same point, we've also seen businesses come and go. We've, you know, every time one opens, another one's closing. So we are in a transition phase, and there's a lot going on downtown, but I give the credit to the people who've invested in downtown and made that, you know, what it is. Now, when you go to the other areas of Troy, like you mentioned, Lansingburg and South Troy, what's going on there? Nothing. Okay. The sidewalks that were created in Lansingburg and South Troy, again, those are things that we passed when we were in office. Okay. So the mayor, he has tried to take credit for that, and that's not even his to take credit for. I'd like to see a business improvement district in Lansingburg. Lansingburg is a tremendous opportunity and has a lot of space and has a lot of residents that would love to spend their money in their very local backyard community, but it hasn't had any attention. It didn't have any attention when I was in there. And prior to that, it was, you know, kind of being known as a forgotten area of Troy. And for the last 4 years, from crime to business to garbage, Lansingburg has remained forgotten. So that's a shame, and that's, you know, that's a neglect, abject neglect of you know, municipal obligations that have not occurred under the last 4 years. You know, if he wants to take credit for that, then, you know, go ahead. But we need to make some changes, and I'm certainly looking to do that immediately. North Central and Lansingburg, primary focus.
Mayor Madden vetoed a city council resolution that would have established the Families and Communities Together Act, which in shorthand many believe would have established Troy as a sanctuary city. Mm-hmm. Where do you stand on that? Would you have vetoed that bill?
Yeah, I would have as well, and I didn't think that sanctuary cities were a topic that honestly the entire city needed to be, honestly, was not focused on. There was a vocal minority, a very small minority within the city that this was a priority for, but citywide it was not. The government, and I believe our government has to deal, you know, it has to protect the weakest of us, okay? I think that the government does best when it helps children and it helps the elderly and people who are not able to provide adequately for themselves. But outside of that, I think government is here for the roads, here for garbage, here for municipal services, our water and our sewer, our public safety. And those are things that have been sorely lacking here in the city of Troy. I had said earlier that the sanctuary city debate, if you will, was somewhat of a distraction because it was a hot button issue. And I think it actually ties into more national politics than what it does here locally. And people, when I'm on the doors and I'm on the street talking to them, they don't want to talk about sanctuary city. And I've told this to many people. When I was campaigning in the primary and getting signatures in the primary, I was talking to Democrats. I wasn't talking to Republicans and conservatives who none of them, you know, want to hear about sanctuary city, but Democrats. And I kid you not, there was five people that actually told me that I'm for it. The rest of them were like, no, please, no, no. So, you know,
And why was it? Was it more just that it wasn't a priority, or was it an opposition to the idea?
Both, actually, both. I would say a 50-50 split. Some of them were just like, what are you talking about? This is not an issue here in Troy. And there was the opposition, which were confused. I understand what a sanctuary city is. And, you know, I also understand it's really not going to have the scare tactic, fear-mongering outcome that a lot of people believe. We're not opening up the gates and, you know, having gangs come in here, you know, because we're now a sanctuary city. That's not, you know, necessarily what is going to happen. But there are some people that believe that, you know, all of a sudden they're going to be taking our resources and, you know, there's just going to be truckloads of people coming in here like refugees. So there is definitely misinformation or lack of information. The people that were really overtly for it, it seemed to have more of a nationalistic tone of national politics, rebuttal of the president, you know, discussion on the southern border and things of that nature. And I'd said to many people, you know, if we were a border town, or we were a town that had a high agrarian agriculture population and foreign immigrants that were involved there, where this really was an issue, where people were cracking down and disrupting families and doing all of that on a regular basis, that might be something that would be appropriate. But Troy is not that. We are a very welcoming city. We're very open. And I've talked to the police officers and in our police department. They know who the illegal aliens who are here, but they work with them. They talk to them. They're not shipping them off. They're not rounding them up. It's just not happening.
Other than at home, where can Trojans find you around town being yourself? In other words, what's one Troy spot that you can hang out in and be yourself?
I call the Daily Grind downtown in my second office. I'm probably there for a couple hours every week getting coffee. I bring my laptop down. I'm talking to people. I have meetings there. I interview new employees down there. You know, it's a good hangout. I see a lot of people, and that's a pretty relaxing spot for me during the day. I love Troy Night Out, and so, you know, you'll find me there. Date night a lot with my wife. We go down to Lucas Confectionery, but we actually try to spread the love. We go around the city all over the place. I'm up here at 41 Sports Bar and Grill. Take my family there. We'll go and have dinner there. We go to Snowman. We're down Miss South Troy Diner. We're all over the place. The Mooza, the Hill, bootleggers. We're out, round and about.
So if there are questions that I didn't ask you during this interview and people want to know, they can find you at the Daily Grind.
Daily Grind, absolutely.
Well, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be here. Let me know anytime you want me to come back, and we'll chat some more.
That was part two of Corinne Carey's interview with Troy Merrill candidate Rodney Wiltshire. Don't forget, the election is November 5th. Correspondent Spencer spoke with Geoffrey Roy Bogard about his experience as a Nature Lab intern at the sanctuary. This is part one of his summer recap.
Geoffrey was an intern at the sanctuary as part of its Nature Lab initiative this summer, and I heard that you worked on some water quality issues. How did some of those go?
Yeah, well, when I got to Troy, I got involved into water testing. So we started by surveying people around the neighborhood and also at the Spirit of the Suffragette concert. So it was important that we first figure out what the people around there thought the issues were. So we kind of look into the things that they are concerned with, big issues people were having with the water. And definitely from all the conversations and survey that people were definitely concerned, like what they were concerned about was a little less clear. But one thing that was very striking is that pretty high ratio of those people did not trust like the tap water. They would rather buy bottled water than use the tap water. So that was like a thing that I've heard over and over again during the summer. So that was definitely something, because, well, bottled water, aside from the obvious environmental impact it has, is pretty expensive. And so if like people could just stop buying that, that would probably be helpful in many, many ways. So yeah, we started looking up closer, and well, since a lot of houses in Troy are pretty old, especially in North Troy, well, one of the concerns was kind of obvious is like the lead, like from the old plumbing pipes and that kind of stuff. So we decided to test for lead, also bacteria, and basic chlorine test. So that was basically what we were looking into during the summer.
Oh, that's great. I mean, it makes sense to test the Troy water. I'm coming here. I just moved here in Troy for the first time this summer, and I noticed some odors that I had never experienced with tap water before, so I can understand the citizens' concern about their tap water.
Like the questions we were asking people, like that kind of stuff, like odor or taste, was kind of frequent in their answers. But again, like, this doesn't always point to like something specific, but that was like one of the main thing that came up, yeah, in the surveys especially.
Okay, great. So were there, when you tested for the lead and bacteria, were there any findings that were unusual?
Well, when it came to bacteria, I found like Troy water was perfectly fine. In fact, like I couldn't, like nothing grew out of the, like Troy's water. So
that's good.
I mean, it makes sense because it's well heavily treated. I had like a few samples of water from like a nearby well water or different sources, and then you can find a few bacteria, nothing like harmful, but like you'll find a few bacteria in like drinking water that are not necessarily a problem. But like in Troy, it's probably like very highly chlorinated, so you don't like have anything growing out of it. So the bacteria side of it is pretty it's pretty safe, but I think it raises other questions about, like, when you have like high level of chlorines, you can get THMs, which are like byproducts of like water chlorination. So when the water like destroy the bacteria, the chemical reaction can produce like side product and chemicals, and those are like very there's not a lot of studies on that stuff, and it's kind of hard to identify, but I think one thing that should be done in the future is like a better like chlorine testing to see if like the level, because it's obviously chlorinated, but it's I don't have like numbers when it comes to that, so I think it could be like a future step if people are still testing water.
Definitely.
And then when it comes to lead testing, I was super happy to realize that no major problem. I found like one house that had a issue, probably from the like house plumbing, the pipes that are old. But I was happy because I was kind of expecting more than that. So I only found one place that was that had like high level of lead.
So no systemic issues. Like,
no, so that's a pretty good thing, meaning that like the city pipe has been changed, and like if there are issues, it's probably more like a personal house like plumbing that could be still have like old pipes or stuff like that. So that when it comes to like the overall of this study, one thing is that every year Troy released like a water quality report, and I mean my findings have been quite similar to theirs, but when I talk to people about it, they don't trust it at all. So I think to maybe push like the study a little further, test for a few more parameters, but then like release it and make like have like a second source, like a citizen-based source of data on the water quality would be like interesting, and maybe would help people to trust their water system and city authorities when they say like the water is safe to drink.
Oh yeah, that's a great plan.
I think that should be like the main focus. I mean, and by doing like more research, if there is an issue, like it will be found. But even I think it is still super important and relevant to do this project, even if at the end of it we don't find anything, because well, that's like the best case scenario actually, is like we don't find anything and we make people realize that this water is like safe to be used, and that if they have concerns about their own tap water, they have like some kind of resources to test it and see for themselves. So
I think
that's a great way that Nature Lab with the Sanctuary has helped in the field of citizen science. I think Nature Lab has fulfilled, or is in the way of fulfilling, this mission pretty well, because hopefully like those testing can be done with people from the community if they have concern after we get the results and stuff. So
that makes so much sense with the purpose of the sanctuary, to do what other groups won't do in Troy, and to increase the power of the people to take it into their own hands to worry about their safety.
Yeah, that's, definitely.
That's great that you're able to do that with the Nature Lab this summer and start that water quality project to hopefully move on to bigger and better things, and help the people in Troy have more confidence in their water quality and to take power in their own hands to test it if they don't.
Yeah, that would be the goal. And like we've reached like around 45 people from like all North Troy. We went and reached out to the people, so it was like really easy for them, and it was like us coming to them and offering like a free service instead of asking them to add basically something else they have to do, like to be as easy as it gets for them. So most people are super busy and don't necessarily have time to deal with that kind of stuff, even if they think it's important. So
that's true.
That's, I think, one of the key point in like making that kind of citizen science and kind of a project, is that you have to go to those people. You can't like expect everyone to take some of their time to take part in your study.
That was part one of Joffrey's experience as a Nature Lab intern, brought to you by current Nature Lab intern and Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Spencer.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Erica.
And I'm Michelle. Our engineer tonight is Alexis. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative and dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.